This is Fesia. I'm calling from Guttenberg, New Jersey. My parents actually moved to America when I was 5 years old from Zambia. We're originally Indian, though. Celebrating Thanksgiving was kind of a foreign concept to them. And it wasn't actually until my sister started dating somebody who wasn't Indian and grew up celebrating Thanksgiving that we started taking part in the festivities. Originally, we used chicken because we had never had turkey ever in my family before. I think my dad brought it home one time from the deli, and we were all just like, what is this foreign meat? We don't understand it. So I guess now what I associate with Thanksgiving is whole roasted chicken, spiced in a semi-Indian way with like some curry. It was just traditional Thanksgiving food and just kicking up the spice.
Hi, I'm Andrew from Boise, Idaho. I know it's Thanksgiving in my house when I'm eating my grandmother's spaghetti. This spaghetti is spaghetti noodles, shells, elbow noodles. I think she just puts in whatever she has. And it's those little translucent cut-up onions that have been cooked maybe for too long and they're kind of squishy. And ground beef, everything kind of stuck inside one dish. And then it's a ton of Hunt's ketchup, never Heinz, and American cheese slapped on top. My grandmother passed away less than a year ago, so this coming Thanksgiving will be the first Thanksgiving without her. And the fact that she's gone obviously hits home, but the fact that the spaghetti part of that equation is also gone is a lot more real, I think, now.
Hello, this is Marcos Roman from Kansas City, Missouri. I grew up in Ponce, Puerto Rico, and I moved to the United States when I was a little boy. Puerto Rico is a commonwealth of the United States, and, you know, Thanksgiving is still a national holiday there. So we kind of embraced it, but we also added things that we eat every day. So I know that it's Thanksgiving in my house because I smell turkey roasted with sofrito and stuffed with mofongo, which is a smashed plantain, rice and beans. Instead of potatoes, yuca roots roasted with garlic and olive oil. And then for dessert, flan, tembleque, which is a coconut custard, arroz con dulce, which is a rice pudding sweetened with coconut milk and raisins, and then coquito, which is an alcoholic eggnog made with coconut milk.
I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast at WNYC. We like to say the Sporkful isn't for foodies, it's for eaters. And let me tell you, I am obsessed with the art of eating. I feel like you only get so many bites in life, and I want to make every bite as delicious as possible. Don't you? I mean, I think that being a great eater is a noble pursuit. And let me tell you, friends, Thanksgiving? Well, Thanksgiving is for eaters. We just heard a few Sporkful listeners who told us how they know it's Thanksgiving in their homes, and we'll hear more of those calls throughout the show. And, you know, what I really love about these calls is that they show how different people meld their own cultures into Thanksgiving traditions and make new traditions. And our meals might be different, but we're really just all trying to get to the same place. We're just trying to share good food with friends and family. But there's a problem. The food doesn't always come out the way we want it to. Sometimes we accidentally fill up on nuts before the meal. Not pointing fingers, just saying. It happens. And our families, well, they don't always cooperate with our visions of bliss, right? For some of us, Thanksgiving just shines a big old spotlight on our insecurities.
I start the day feeling inadequate because I don't cook on Thanksgiving.
That's Mo Rocca from CBS Sunday Morning and Cooking Channel's My Grandmother's Ravioli. If Thanksgiving gets you down, well, Mo can help.
There are a number of things you can do. You can send a lot of emails to people just saying Happy Thanksgiving and making sure it's personalized so that they don't just get like a group text. So that might make yourself feel better. And I look for a historic site to bring my mother to. I know that sounds kind of weird.
Like a physical place?
Yeah. But there's only so many times you can visit Mount Vernon.
Stay tuned, eaters, because in this show, I'm going to enlist a bunch of my friends to find out how to have the most fun and delicious Thanksgiving ever. I'll talk to Amy Sedaris about hosting at Thanksgiving, and she'll tell you what not to bring to her house if she ever invites you over. And I'll get deep with Radiolab's Robert Krulwich. We'll talk about a timeless question of eating. At what point in the meal should you eat the best bite? And on the media's Brooke Gladstone and I try to cook together to disastrous effects. I mean, just imagine everything that could ever go wrong in a kitchen. That's what went wrong. Plus, Thanksgiving for vegetarians, the science of turkey cooking, and why a turkey is just like a tube of toothpaste. From WNYC and The Sporkful, it's Thanksgiving is for Eaters, with me, Dan Pashman. You're going to learn, you're going to laugh, you're going to get really hungry. I promise. Stay with us. All right, we're going to get to the meal, but before that, let's lay out some ground rules about being a host and being a guest. What is a good guest, after all? What do you do if you're stuck with a bad one? Amy Sedaris wrote a book called I Like You, Hospitality Under the Influence, and it's totally hilarious, as you'd expect, because she's amazing. But if you read it, you'll learn that she also actually cares very deeply about entertaining people in her home. I talked to her live on stage at WNYC's Jerome L. Green Performance Space. So let's talk hosting around the holidays. What are some of the things that you like for people to bring you if they're a guest that come into your house?
Weed. I answer that too quickly. I don't always like them to surprise me with something to serve. Because if you've planned the menu out, like one time I was having this big traditional Greek dinner and someone showed up with their grandparents and a chocolate cake and that was a double whammy.
So like when someone says, oh, Amy, I can't wait to come to your house, what can I bring?
Mm-hmm.
What do you say?
Sometimes it depends who it is. Sometimes I'm like ice, you know, if they really want to, or I'm like, you know, beer. Or, you know, something like, I know it's not, you know, maybe it's too heavy for me to bring up, like charcoal, bird seed, or kitty litter, but I'll get them to bring things like that. Or I'm always like, forks, bring forks, or sharp knives. Like, could you really use some sharp knives? Or bring your own container, because I know you're going to want to take some food home, you know? So, you know, little things like that, but very seldom do I really, or ice cream, you know, you give them the easy stuff.
Right. So I put the call out on Facebook and asked people for questions about hosting for you. Karen writes, how do I keep drunk guests from quote-unquote helping with cleanup?
Oh.
My sisters-in-law have broken more wine goblets with their hams for hands than I even care to count. What's your advice for Karen?
It's such a problem.
Yeah.
It is such a problem to get people out of your house. My favorite thing to do is to clean up. I mean, I know people have a hard time believing that, but then you can reminisce about the party. You can talk about the disasters or whatever. You know, usually if they're drunk, they've been told before, you need to go home now. You know what I mean?
Right. But they're relatives. That makes it harder to kick them out.
You need to go home now. I think it's easier if they're a relative, don't you? Dad, mom. Yeah, I think it's just, you know, easier.
Jeff Childs writes, one year my wife's aunt, who had volunteered to bring the turkey, called 30 minutes after dinner was supposed to start to say she was just leaving and would be at our house in about an hour. She said she would finish cooking the turkey when she got to our house.
Fantastic. I love that. Yeah. That is hilarious.
Should we have eaten without her and without the turkey?
Well, why did they put her in charge of the turkey? Is this a pattern of hers? Is she always late? That's happened to me before. Like, people are coming at 5 and the girl just arrived with the turkey uncooked and didn't even apologize. And then I thought, oh, well, that's stupid. I should have done that.
Well, this is one of the things you talk about in your book is, like, people need to know their limitations.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you're chronically late and disorganized, don't volunteer to bring the turkey to Thanksgiving.
Right.
But it's also a food safety hazard, because now you've got a half-cooked turkey coming to room temperature in the backseat of a car.
Oh, that's so stupid. So stupid.
Right?
I think I would have panicked, and I would have maybe gone to some kind of a grocery store that makes roasted chickens or roasted turkeys, and I think I would have just gotten it. And then I would say, Mom, or Grandma, whatever, you stupid lady, we're still going to make your turkey, but we're going to make it for tomorrow for leftovers. It's just too late right now.
Okay.
I think that's what I would do.
On Facebook, Linda Pashman writes...
I was going to say, okay.
Mom, writing on my Facebook page again, how do you handle dinner guests who arrive with their pets? I know you're an animal lover.
Yeah.
But if someone comes with a pet that they didn't tell you about, how do you respond to that?
Well, usually if I know they have a pet, I'll make a point to say, don't bring your dog. And then they bring the dog, and then they pick the most expensive bowl you have in your kitchen, and they put it down for water in a spot that everyone's going to be walking by. It always happens, doesn't it? Plus, I have a rabbit, and I'm like, your dog, we don't know if they're going to get along, and then that means I have to lock my bedroom up, and there goes the airflow. I mean, people have no idea.
Another question on Facebook from Linda Pashman.
The Pashman family.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. What about the guest who's the perennial provocateur, usually a relative? How do you ward off the expected annual family conflict? And a related question, what do you do when your mom handles family conflict by asking you questions through your podcast Facebook page?
Uh-oh. That's pretty good.
Any tips, Amy, for dealing with family at the holidays?
Well, my family, we all get along. And whenever there's a, if there is a fight or a conflict or whatever, we all just get excited. And we're a fantastic audience for it. You know what I mean? I think I'd be happy to have a fight. I think it's just like it's entertaining and it's fun. I love to hear people arguing or complaining. I mean, that's when I worked in as a waitress forever, and I loved it when someone would get up my face and complain about something. I mean, I wouldn't respond by yelling back at them or getting mad. You know, I would just be like, I can't believe you're so angry about this, you know? But when it's family, you just eat it up, and then you divide up, and you go into the bedroom, and you talk to somebody about it, and then you go, so you're two-faced about it the whole night. You play both sides. It's great. That's right. Take this, swallow that. You'll be fine. Yeah. It's easy.
Well, Amy Sedaris, I'm so glad that you could be here. I really appreciate it. Big hand, ladies and gentlemen, for Amy Sedaris.
Thank you.
Okay, so note to self. If I ever get invited to Amy Sedaris' house, bring kitty litter. And another note to self, get invited to Amy Sedaris' house. Gotta work on that. Anyway, moving on. We've heard a lot about how to host. I think it's time we start cooking. And I should say that I myself have only cooked 4 or 5 turkeys in my whole life. My wife and I bought our first home a few years ago, and we haven't hosted many Thanksgivings yet. Now, so far, I've been a briner. That means I submerge my turkey in a saltwater brine, and it's delicious. But I was curious to learn how a brine actually works, like on a scientific level, and to find out whether there might be better alternatives. So I turned to Kenji Lopez-Ault, Managing Culinary Director at Sirius Eats. Kenji is MIT-educated, he's a trained chef, the guy loves to eat, and his food lab column is just a must-read. I never miss it.
Why don't we talk about, first of all, what brining is exactly? So a brine is a solution of salt and water. Muscle proteins contract when you cook them, and they squeeze out liquid. What a brine does is that the salt in the brine actually dissolves some of the muscle proteins, mainly a protein called myosin. And by dissolving that protein, it looses up those muscle fibers so that when you subsequently cook it, they don't contract as much. So your bird is able to maintain more of that moisture. I find that a wet brine sometimes, it's overkill. It makes the turkey almost too juicy, and it gives it a sort of like ham-like.
Too juicy? Did those words just come out of your mouth?
Well, it's a question of what do you want in your mouth, and I want all the juices that are coming out of the turkey to taste really strongly of turkey. When you're doing a brine, the juices coming out of the turkey taste like tap water. Now, personally, what I do is called a dry brine. It could also be called a cure or just simply salt rubbing, which, you know, I feel offers you a better balance between retaining juiciness while also retaining flavor. So what you do is you take a turkey, you rub it with salt, and then you let it sit basically overnight or up to a few nights in that salt rub.
How much salt is a thick coating?
I would say for a typical 10 to 12 pound turkey, you'd want about 2 tablespoons of kosher salt sprinkled over the entire surface.
So the turkey's sitting in the fridge, covered in salt. Mm-hmm. What's happening to it?
So what initially happens is that salt will pull out some of the moisture of the turkey.
That sounds terrible.
Yeah, it sounds terrible, right? It's through a process called osmosis, which you probably remember from fifth grade science.
Yeah, I remember AP Bio, Mrs. Daner.
Yep. So what happens is the salt dissolves in some of the liquid on the surface of the turkey. And so over the course of a few days, that salt will actually sort of slowly work its way deeper and deeper into the bird, relaxing muscle fibers as it goes. So in the end, you end up with an effect that's very similar to brining, but you don't have any of that excess water added to it. So the turkey is able to retain more of its natural juices.
So it's the same level of tenderness that you get with brining without the performance-enhancing juiciness.
You get more juiciness than an unsalted turkey because the muscle proteins don't contract as much once you cook them. So, you know, if you imagine a turkey's muscle fiber is sort of like a tube of toothpaste, when you cook it, you're basically squeezing that tube and all the liquid's coming out of the end and evaporating into the oven or maybe dripping down into the roasting pan. So what the salt does, either in a brine or in a dry rub, is it basically just weakens the grip on that tube of toothpaste, so you're not squeezing it as tightly. With the brine, you're actually adding liquid into there with a salt rub. All you're doing is preventing liquid from that's already there from coming out as much. One trick you can actually use to get extra crispy skin is another one that doesn't quite work if you're brining. But if you're dry brining, if you mix a little bit of baking powder in with your salt and spread that over the surface of the bird, let it sit uncovered in the fridge for a night or two, you can actually look at the difference in the skin, and you'll see that it creates these kind of micro blisters in the skin that add a lot of surface area and a lot of extra crunch.
I'm going to need to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk a bit about basting.
Uh-huh.
Controversial issue in the food science community, Kenji. I grew up with my mom basting. That was part of the ritual. She would need help taking the turkey out. I used to love to baste. I think the baster
yeah, it's a
is
lot of fun,
a
right?
fun
yeah.
device. And I also think, as I've suggested, I like the turkey cooking experience to be sort of momentous and time-consuming and involved. I think that's part of the fun mm-hmm. of the holiday for me. So the idea of just putting the turkey in the oven and then not doing anything for 3 or 4 hours, it's like,
right.
what else am I going to do besides take it out and poke it and prod it?
Exactly. No, I think that's where basting actually came from, is that you just had to have something to do while it's in there.
But if I'm basting the turkey, am I actually accomplishing anything?
Well, one thing you're certainly not doing is adding more moisture to it. If you go back to our toothpaste tube analogy, when you're cooking your turkey, you're putting pressure on that tube, you're squeezing things out, and you're really not going to be forcing anything back in there, certainly not by pouring it on top. Mainly what you're doing is regulating the surface temperature. So it can be beneficial because it helps your turkey cook a little bit more evenly, and that in turn can lead to more internal moisture at the end because you're not going to be heating up the exterior.
Okay.
What I do, if you're not too set on having that perfect Norman Rockwell, completely intact, plump, juicy turkey at the centerpiece, the best way to cook a turkey is to spatchcock it, to cut out its backbone and lay it flat, splay out its legs, press down on its breast so that it's flat.
Like butterflying it.
Butterflying it, exactly. And you can get your butcher to do that for you. So you know the difference between light meat and dark meat, breast meat and leg meat.
Sure. I know that dark meat is better.
Right, well.
But we want people to continue to think that white meat is better so that there's more dark meat for me.
And the reason dark meat is better is that because it can withstand higher cooking temperatures without drying out. So, you know, the problem is that you have one bird and you have two different target temperatures you're going for. And the way we traditionally cook a turkey with its breast exposed, we're actually exacerbating that problem because the breasts end up cooking even faster than the leg meat does. So by butterflying the turkey and laying it flat, you'll notice that the thighs and the legs that used to be most protected with a whole bird are now the most exposed parts. So with a butterfly turkey, you can put it into a really hot oven, 450 degrees. It'll cook in about half the time that a normal turkey takes to cook. And the breast will end up finishing cooking at just about the same time as the thighs and legs finish cooking. And then beyond that, you also end up with all of the skin on top of the bird. So that by butterflying your turkey, you get the most evenly cooked meat, you get the juiciest meat, and you get maximum crispiness.
Kenji Lopez-Alt, Managing Culinary Director of Serious Eats. He writes the Food Lab column, which is just a must-read for anyone who wants to learn about cooking and eating. Kenji, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Kenji Lopez-Alt is also the author of The Food Lab, Better Home Cooking Through Science. And I gotta say, after talking to him, I think I might try the dry salt rub this year. The idea of changing things up does make me a little nervous. It's a little riskier, but I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready. Coming up, we'll talk about celebrating Thanksgiving when you're a vegetarian. And New York Times food editor Sam Sifton will tell me the one thing you could do at Thanksgiving that he would consider a grievous insult. Stay with us. Welcome back to Thanksgiving is for Eaters from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast. Recently, we put the call out to my Sporkful listeners and asked, how do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? Here are some of your responses.
This is Allison from New Jersey, and I know it's Thanksgiving in my house because the smell of competition is in the air. Every year, my family has a Thanksgiving competition with about 20 people, and everyone votes on the best dish. In the early years, we had two grandmothers competing against each other, so we established kind of a first, second, third place so that nobody had to pick which grandmother they liked best. you know, that was helpful to my aunt, who also hosts every year and would always threaten not to host again if she didn't win.
My name is Melissa. I'm from Virginia. The black side of my family is from South Carolina. My mom is 100% Russian Jewish, but she didn't cook much before she got married, so everything she learned from my grandmother. So she's been cooking African-American food for about 60 years. And I know it's Thanksgiving in my house when you smell all kinds of yummy African-American foods. We have cornbread, the ham, the turkey, the collard greens, and definitely the mac and cheese. You can also smell candied yams, definitely with the marshmallows on the top. We do rice a lot more than we do potatoes. Rice and gravy is one of my favorite things.
I gotta say, I really love hearing all these calls because they show me that there are just so many different ways to celebrate Thanksgiving. And I cover a couple of the more outlandish ways in my book, Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. At one point, I advise that you make what I call the stuffing sandwich. This is great on Thanksgiving Day or for leftovers. What you do is you beat a couple of eggs, then you take a couple of baseball-sized balls of stuffing. You mix the beaten eggs in with the stuffing. You take those two balls of stuffing mixed with the egg, and you put them into a frying pan with hot oil, and you press them flat. And you fry up that stuffing until it turns into two golden brown, crispy, delicious stuffing patties. Then you use those patties in place of sandwich bread. A little cranberry sauce, a little mashed potato, nice slice of turkey in there. It's crispy, it's delicious. You know that itch in your belly that only a big bite of fat can scratch? This sandwich will scratch that itch. And there's a video of me making a stuffing sandwich on my website, sporkful.com. So the stuffing sandwich is delicious, but there are even more different ways to celebrate Thanksgiving. And do you know that some of them don't even involve eating turkey? Have you guys heard about this? These people, they call themselves that doesn't sound right, vegetarian? Oh, I'm kidding. I know what vegetarians are. In fact, some of my best friends are vegetarians, and one of them is joining me right now, my good friend, L.V. Anderson. She's Slate's food and drink editor, and she's also a vegetarian. Hey, Laura.
Hi, Dan.
So what do you people look forward to eating on Thanksgiving?
Everything except for the turkey. That's my basic answer.
What about you in particular? What are the highlights for you?
Stuffing is a personal favorite. I wish I could eat it more often, but I also know that typically only served once a year is what makes it so special.
And so you don't feel like you're missing out at all on Thanksgiving?
I really don't. As far as I'm concerned, the side dishes are what make Thanksgiving special and amazing and something to look forward to. So I really just don't feel like I'm missing out on anything.
Okay. But part of what I love about Thanksgiving is that it is an event. It's such a food-centric event holiday. And the turkey is the crescendo of the event. It's the centerpiece. It becomes the centerpiece of the entire table. It is an event dish. And that's where I feel like you're missing out.
I agree with you. I like the visual appeal of a turkey. I like that there is something big and impressive and eye-catching at the middle of the table. But that doesn't seem like reason enough to cook something just because it looks awesome, you know?
That's why, Laura, I've invented the veggie duckin. Okay, I have this dish, which I think I've told you about before, that is a centerpiece dish, time-consuming, momentous, glorious, and all vegetarian, that can bring us together. This is where we can meet in the middle.
Yeah, and remind me, what are the different layers of the veggie ducking?
Well, it's
ducken. Excuse me. Veggie ducken.
It's inspired by the turducken, which, of course, is a chicken inside a duck inside a turkey with stuffing between each layer. But this is, at the core, you have sweet potatoes, then stuffing, then leeks, then stuffing. Then you put all that inside a giant banana squash, which is a squash that's about 2 feet long. It's like the biggest squash money can buy. And you cook that for a couple of hours, and then you slice it up. And it is an event. What do you think of it?
I think that sounds great. I can't believe I haven't tried one yet. I obviously need to make that a part of...
I'm a little hurt.
Yeah.
All right, well, Laura Anderson, Slate readers know her as L.V. Anderson. She's Slate's food and drink editor. People can find your work at slate.com. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you, Dan. Happy Thanksgiving.
I really do hope that vegetarians out there will give the veggie duckin' a shot. I think this is a dish that could bring us all together. And one Sporkful listener, Dan Goldstein, he tried it out and he dropped me an email. He said it made him feel more involved in Thanksgiving than he normally gets to feel as a vegetarian. So I was happy to hear that. Thanks for your email, Dan. So at this point, we've covered a lot of the finer points of Thanksgiving. I think it's time we talk big picture with a guy who I think is going to make us all feel a lot more confident. Sam Sifton is the New York Times food editor and the author of Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. And, you know, what I love about Sam is that he is super smart, but also really accessible. I think he can help us strip away a lot of the Thanksgiving distractions and focus on what really matters. When I sat down with Sam, we started off talking about the sort of inherent tension, I think, that exists in Thanksgiving between the desire to carry on certain traditions and the pressure that I think some of us feel to come up with new tricks.
The food media, of which I am a part, each year comes to Thanksgiving with a new idea. Here's a new way to make the turkey. Here are seven great appetizers to change your Thanksgiving feast. And that creates pressure on those of us who are cooking Thanksgiving because we think, well, I guess I do need something new. I can't make my mom's Brussels sprouts again. But really, when else do you make your mom's Brussels sprouts? They're pretty good, or they're terrible and you should abandon them in favor of something else. Right. But the point of Thanksgiving should be an embrace of the tradition rather than fear of the tradition. And embracing that helps make it a much better holiday.
To me, what makes the turkey special on Thanksgiving is that turkey just takes so damn long. By necessity, it is a project. And I feel like people should embrace the momentousness of the turkey.
That's right. There's another line in my book that I repeat always, which has to do with appetizers, which I believe have no place in the Thanksgiving meal.
Yes, I'm so glad to hear you say this. Save the stomach space for the main attraction.
I do, as I've said many times, have a problem with this notion that I spent 8 hours creating a main dish, the turkey or the tofurkey or whatever that is, and like six sides, and I got these pies coming. You come into my house and eat 2 pounds of cashews and then refuse seconds on my turkey? That's a grievous insult to me. There are no mixed nuts in my house. Well, there's my family, but there aren't mixed nuts on the table.
I was also surprised to see in your book that you recommend cooking the turkey to 165 degrees.
As opposed to?
I mean, my mom likes it really, well, sometimes even say 159, which, I mean, the FDA would be calling right now and arguing. Well, I say 160.
Well, listen, the truth of the matter here is you're going to get an increase in the internal temperature of the meat after it comes out of the oven. The turkey is going to continue to cook itself for some time as it sits on the sideboard. The moms that I have come in contact with in my Thanksgiving reporting fall into two camps. There is on the one side the mom who cooks it to like 190 degrees Celsius and serves the cardboard turkey and is perfectly safe, albeit not very happy. On the other side of the equation are moms like your mom and my mom who skirt pretty close to running blood at the corners. I think at 165, you're in really, really good shape. If you've got a tight skin on the bird, if you've started it at a high temperature and then brought it down and you pull it out of the oven at 160, you're going to be at 167 by the time, 168 by the time you carve, and you're in great shape.
It sounds like what you're saying is that mothers are all driven by anxiety, but their anxiety drives them into one of two camps. Either they're anxious about people getting sick or they're anxious about having dry turkey.
And this is what I seek to allay in my book and in my evangelizing on this subject. Thanksgiving is a big deal to people because they don't cook enough the rest of the year. And if you spend some time cooking chickens, cooking a duck maybe, cooking a smaller turkey for your friends at other times of the year, if you get used to the idea that a bunch of people are going to come into your house and have a good time around your table, Thanksgiving anxiety decreases.
Let's talk about setting the stage for Thanksgiving.
As a nation, We have grown up with this image of what a Thanksgiving table looks like. It's an image that was delivered to us by Norman Rockwell in his famous painting, Freedom from Want, where you have this picture-perfect family of white people with the old lady at the end with the perfect turkey and the angelic children looking up. It's an image that was later appropriated for American Gangster with Denzel Washington at the head of the table. It's in many ways a beautiful image of what family life at Thanksgiving can be. Most people can't pull that off, right? So they get nervous about it. And just the simple act of taking the setting of the table seriously helps. If you find yourself in a situation where you're thinking, you know what, there are a lot of people coming over, I think I'm going to go with the paper plates, that's a mistake.
Yeah, I feel like real plates and real utensils, it's kind of like the, like in a car, leather seats versus cloth seats. Like you sit down in a leather seat in a car and you just feel classier.
I hope that your listeners aren't considering paper plates versus real plates. But I'll tell you where you do see the issue arise, and it's in the napkin. The napkin is a tell. Getting a cloth napkin, folding it, making it neat, making it nice, and putting it under the fork or forks at a Thanksgiving table, that's your leather interior.
Sam Sifton, food editor for the New York Times and author of the excellent book, Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. Happy Thanksgiving.
And to you, sir.
All right, guys, can I make a confession to you? The first time that my wife and I hosted Thanksgiving in our new home, we used paper napkins. But no more. Sam has inspired me. Only cloth napkins from here on out. Now coming up, the most inspiring Thanksgiving topic of all, eating. Radiolab's Robert Krulwich will join me to talk about the pursuit of the perfect Thanksgiving bite and the time a turkey fell in love with his wife. And On the Media's Brooke Gladstone and I try to cook dessert together, and everything imaginable goes wrong. Very, very wrong. Stay with us. Hey guys, it's Dan. I am parachuting into this podcast from another time and place. A time and place where I have a cold. But I wanted to make sure to remind you to please subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or the podcast app or wherever you get it. And that helps us out. It helps us go up in the rankings. More people can discover our show. And it helps you out because that way you'll never miss an episode. So please go ahead and hit that subscribe button right now while you're listening. Thanks. Welcome back to Thanksgiving is for Eaters from WNYC. I'm Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful Food Podcast at Sporkful.com. As I said earlier, we asked Sporkful podcast listeners to call in and answer one question. How do you know it's Thanksgiving in your house? Here are a few more of your answers.
I'm Chase from Los Angeles, and I know it's Thanksgiving in my house when my mom is making her famous sweet potatoes. So ordinarily, you think of sweet potatoes with the marshmallows on top. But these sweet potatoes are mashed with cream cheese, about a half a stick of butter, and then they're topped with blue cheese, which is totally just throws everything out of whack. You know, this is one of those foods that even though we only eat it once a year, we spend the rest of the year thinking about it and wishing that we could eat it.
Hi, Dan. It's Janie, your wife. I know it's Thanksgiving in our house when you've been drinking since about 9:30 in the morning, but mostly I feel like I know it's Thanksgiving in our house when the kitchen is pretty much off limits to everyone except Dan after 9 a.m., and the house smells amazing all day. But seriously, Thanksgiving is a great holiday in our house. It's one of my favorite days of the year. I know, Dan, that you get really excited and plan the meal for a long time, and it definitely pays off. Dan, you make a great Thanksgiving meal, and everyone has a great time getting together and eating delicious food.
Oh, thanks, sweetie. That was a nice call. Although, I don't think I usually start drinking on Thanksgiving till at least, like, 10, right? I mean, not 9, that sounds a little early. But it is true that when I'm spending the day in the kitchen cooking on Thanksgiving, I like a drink.
My friend Rosie Schapp is the drinks columnist for the New York Times Magazine. She also tends bar at South in Brooklyn. And she recommends a drink she invented called the Autumn Bonfire. So let me get my ingredients here. Let's see, it's one part Applejack, one part smoky scotch, which people should mix more with smoky scotch, one part non-alcoholic apple cider. Rosie says sometimes she cooks the apple cider down just a little bit to make it a little thicker. And then just a couple of dashes of bitters and a splash of maple syrup. Shake it with ice and sip away your Thanksgiving worries. Oh, man. I hope you guys are having as much fun as I am, eaters. But there's a crucial part of Thanksgiving that we haven't covered yet. Eating. My favorite part. Now, as I think I've made clear, eating for me is an almost religious experience. Eating's deep. So I need someone I can get deep with, someone I can have a real meaningful conversation with. And I knew the person to turn to is Radio Lab's Robert Krulwich. I talked to him live on stage at WNYC's Green Performance Space. So I want to talk a bit with you about Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And the holidays, Thanksgiving in particular, Thanksgiving eating.
Yes.
Okay. I want to get deep with you for a minute.
Okay.
Because I know that on Radio Lab, you guys get pretty existential.
Yes.
You talk about big issues.
Very wise.
One of the big issues that people ask me a lot about that I've never really addressed much on The Sporkful, but I think it's such a crucial question, is at what point in a meal should you take the best bite? Like, the plate is arrayed before you, and, I mean, if it's Thanksgiving, you know, let's say you see the perfect piece of turkey with just the right amount of crispy fat and just the right amount of juicy meat and the potatoes and the stuffing, they're all just right, you know, you see that bite. Do you want to take that bite right away? Do you save it for the end on a high note, or somewhere in the middle?
You cannot tell what your best bite will be, Dan.
That's good. That's a good answer.
And
I like that.
And here's why.
Please
tell
me.
Because the reason it's the best bite is because you may look at, say, the crispy turkey part that appears to be something coming your way, which gets a 10 in your mind, or the mashed potatoes, or the cranberries, or whatever it is, and you'll say, there it is. There's the thing I love. And then, by the by, a string bean that you did not anticipate will come, in my case, flying into your mouth. And that string bean will be an enormous surprise to you. And that surprise turns into the best bite. That is, you can never know the best bite. It is a shock and awe moment.
Well, that's, yeah. Yeah.
And everybody knows this.
Yeah. That's such a great answer, and it's really in keeping with your approach to life, Robert. Because asking at what point in the meal do you want to have your best bite is kind of like asking, like, at what point in your life, like a meal is like a miniature lifetime. It's like, at what point in your life do you want to have your best day?
Right, you can't know that. Right, exactly. You've learned my lesson.
Okay. It's funny because I usually go for somewhere in the middle of the meal because I feel like. People who say save it to the end, I disagree with. Because your appetite is primed, your palate is primed, there is such thing as palate fatigue. So you're not going to get as much enjoyment from the best bite if you save it for the end. But to have your very first bite be the best bite, it's sort of like, you know, what do you have to look forward to after that?
That's right, yes. There's a sexual equivalent of that, you know. You get into bed, boom, and then that's you need to wait a little longer.
Right. Yeah. I think that's right. I think that's right. But you can't always plan it.
You can't plan it. The girls don't always know this. You just can't plan it.
Let's talk turkey in general. Are you a fan of turkeys?
I love turkey. I love turkey more than any other meat.
Really?
I wouldn't have said that 10 years ago. I would have preferred a cow part.
What changed?
I don't know. Maturity? I don't know. Maybe the turkeys got better. I don't know. I don't know.
And you had told me you also had an encounter. You started telling me a while back with a...
Yes.
Tell me about that
I have a house on Shelter Island, which is about 100 miles east of here. And I have a neighbor behind my house who's he's the concrete king of Shelter Island. He has an enormous house, and he has a bowling alley in it or something. But he also has an obsession with animal collecting. And he has small miniature cattle. And he also has recently been raising extraordinary turkeys. And one of them has somehow strayed from the reservation, and he's come through the woods, and he comes to my house. And he's a turkey. He's a wild turkey. I know he's from New Larson's house. I say, hello, turkey. He's like, not the smartest animal. And he fell in love with my wife. I mean, this is a weird... He looked at her and then and just decided to get very close to her.
Wait, she looked at her like you were inside or outside, or where were you?
I was, at first, he was in the backyard. We don't have a backyard, we have like a meadow. He came through the meadow and he just sat there, and then he looked at her.
Through the window?
No, she was out in the real world, and then he kind of came really unusually close to her, I thought. And then he just hung with her wherever she went. When she would go inside, he'd wait patiently by the door. And then the next morning at about 5:30, he was there again. And the next morning, so for some strange reason, I became jealous of this animal. So I would go out with my tennis racket and go whack, and then tell him that he couldn't like her so much. And I said, well, he's a turkey. I said, must have turkey friends. I mean, you have all those other turkeys. I finally called the Larsons and said, there is a turkey that is making moves on my wife. You have to get that turkey back.
And what did your wife, what was her take on all this?
She was a little bit charmed to be adored by such a large... This will make this Thanksgiving extra special, I feel.
Let's talk a bit about leftovers.
Okay.
Do you have a specific strategy for leftovers? I mean, how do you like to eat your leftovers?
Always, whenever, anytime, on Thanksgiving, after Thanksgiving, the next morning, the next afternoon, the next evening, friends' houses, small gatherings, post-gatherings, later gatherings, later in the week.
But how do you do, after a few days of Thanksgiving, there's like two things you're tired of, right? You're tired of, some people may be, you're not, tired of your own Thanksgiving food, and you may be a little tired of hanging out with your family.
Mm.
So I recommend what I call a leftovers exchange party.
Yes.
Invite over friends, they bring all their leftovers, you put them all out on the table, everyone eats everyone's leftovers, you get rid of your leftovers, and you get to try different foods, and you learn new recipes for next year.
We do this. We do that. We've done this like for 4 years. We go.
Well, oh, you mean you've already read my book?
No, this may shock you.
But I didn't...
having not even read the book, this was invented before you were born. I mean, I don't know. Like, there are people who, at least on the Upper West Side, who do this very thing. They invite you over, usually with their kids. So then your kids and their kids, they all know each other, and then you go sit there and you. In my case, I just eat everything. I don't speak at all.
So. All right, well, Robert Krulwich is the co-host of WNYC's Radio Lab. Robert, it's always a pleasure to hang out and speak with you. Big hand for Robert Krulwich.
Thank you.
That's Robert Krulwich from WNYC's Radio Lab. And Robert showed you right there, folks, with that story about the turkey and his wife, exactly why the only turkeys I let near my wife are the ones that come out of my oven, okay? Now, I hope at this point you guys are feeling a little more confident. I'm feeling more confident, I know. I think I'm just about ready, but maybe some of us still have some doubts about whether we can pull off this Thanksgiving. So, I know who we have to call.
Thanks for calling the Butterball Turkey Talk Line. Nicole speaking. How can I help you?
Hey, Nicole, it's Dan Pashman from The Sporkful at WNYC. How are you?
Hey, Dan. Great. How are you?
Good, good. So, you know, I got my listeners here, and we've all been talking this whole hour about Thanksgiving and the do's and don'ts and having a lot of fun in the process, but it would be great if you could help us out just a little bit.
Of course. That's why we're here.
What would you say is the most common question that people call up with?
The common question that we get year after year is, how do I go about thawing my turkey?
Ah, yes, the frozen turkey problem.
So allow me to tell you the two acceptable, the safe methods. One is refrigeration method. Keeping in mind it takes 24 hours for every 4 pounds of turkey meat to thaw in your refrigerator. And the other acceptable method to thaw your turkey is the cold water bath method, a shorter method, a method for folks to use if they're short on time. It's a half hour per pound.
And that's so just that. And the cold water bath, you just drop the whole turkey in a bucket of cold water?
A bucket of cold water or your kitchen sink, right, leaving the wrapper on, facing it breast side down in the cold water bath, ideally changing the water every half hour or so. to keep the water fresh and to continue the thawing process will ensure your turkey's fully thawed. And then you just put it, again, wrapper intact, back in the refrigerator until you are ready to begin your roasting process.
I'm sure people ask you all the time, what's the craziest call you ever got? When you hear that question, I mean, what are some of the calls that pop into your head?
The phone call that I always like is the father or the single guy that is in the grocery store on their cell phone, and we're talking them through the whole Thanksgiving grocery shopping process. They want to know what size turkey to buy. We ask them how many guests they're having. We give them a recommendation. And then a lot of times it's, well, I know you know turkeys, but can you also help me with stuffing? Can you also help me with dessert? Can you help me with the mashed potatoes? And we just kind of walk with them as if we're there right alongside them in the grocery store.
You know, in my family, I know that people have strong opinions about the way the turkey should be cooked.
Oh, agree. Mine too.
Have you ever been in a situation where someone called you up to basically ask you to play referee?
Yes. It's usually a husband and wife.
Right.
And I'll tell the wife one thing, or I will recommend something different to the husband, and they'll say, you know what? Let me put you on speaker. Let me put you on speaker so my husband can hear. And then, you know, you hear like this banter going back and forth, and see, she told you. And it's always pretty cute because I, too, have a strong family dynamic and very strong opinions, and I'm thinking, okay, I can empathize with this.
Do you get extra cred when there is a disagreement in your family over the way things should be cooked? Are they like, well, if Nicole says it's this way, she must be right, or will people argue with you?
Well, you know, surprisingly enough, my in-laws, my husband's family, they really listen to my advice, but it's my own family sometimes. I'll tell my dad how to carve, I'll recommend a certain way to carve or a certain way to store the leftovers. Well, they know, they've been doing it for a lot longer than I have, and so sometimes I think that, you know, they don't listen to my advice maybe as much as they should.
Nicole Johnson in Maple Park, Illinois, mother of four. 14 years with the Butterball Turkey Talk Line at 1-800-BUTTERBALL. Thanks so much, Nicole.
Thank you.
So you see, even the Butterball Turkey lady's family argues with her. So when your family argues with you, don't feel so bad. There's one thing that every family can agree on. It's dessert. So let's talk about that. The first thing I'll say about dessert is you should wait to eat it. After Thanksgiving dinner, take a break. Go for a walk, stretch the legs. Once you get back, you're going to want to put something sweet in your mouth. My friend Brooke Gladstone from On the Media was telling me about this dessert that she makes at Thanksgiving called cracker pudding. It's got milk, sugar, coconut. I love coconut. But here's the real clincher. It has saltines. Saltines. Now, I love saltines, but I have never had them in a dessert. So I went to Brooke's house to investigate. She started by crumbling the saltines.
Okay. I'm going to just break these up. I have to say them.
Before you knew it, things went off the rails.
And by no means wash your hands, because it's all going to get burned off anyway.
That's right.
From there, it was basically one disaster after another. And it was so much fun. Here's just a small taste of the half hour or so Brooke and I spent working on the cracker pudding.
No. Oh, my God. I just realized. Hold this. I hope this works. Oh, and I'm supposed to add some vanilla, which I forgot. What the f***? This is now ready for a taste.
But in spite of our ups and downs, Brooke and I made it through, and it was time to eat.
Oh, man.
Brooke topped the cracker pudding with beaten egg whites that she browned in the oven. So the egg whites were kind of light and frothy on top, and then the pudding was rich and dense underneath. It was sweet and creamy and full of coconut. But then the saltines, that's what sets it apart. That's the key. So you end up with a sort of like a salted coconut pudding effect, and it was decadent.
Now you just want to eat this whole pot? I mean...
Are you going anywhere?
Brooke Gladstone is the co-host and managing editor of WNYC's On the Media. Her recipe for cracker pudding and a video of Brooke and me having fun in the kitchen are at Sporkful.com. So you see, eaters, even when things in the kitchen go horribly, horribly wrong, like splatter on the walls wrong, the meal can still have a happy ending. I hope now you're feeling as good about Thanksgiving as I am. I am pumped up for the holiday, and I learned a lot. But let's hear a few parting words of advice and inspiration from some of today's guests. Amy Sedaris on hosting.
I would just make it as easy as pie and just ask people to help and contribute. Boom, you got it.
Mo Rocca on Dealing with Family.
Life is not a movie of the week, and there's not going to be some great resolution or a coming to terms, probably. There's not. And the best you can do is manage situations. And you should feel proud about that. You should feel like that's an accomplishment.
And Sam Sifton on cooking.
Everything is going to be all right. That's the message I'm here to deliver. You're going to display a kind of self-confidence that maybe you don't feel inside. There's going to be plenty of food. And if it looks as if there's not, you're going to pour double-sized drinks.
Thank you all so much for tuning in. Remember, you can find recipes, videos, and links to the Sporkful podcast at sporkful.com. Thanksgiving is for Eaters has been a production of WNYC Radio. It was produced by Kristen Meinzer, Ann Sani, and me. Our engineers were Bill Moss and Bill O'Neill. We got web help from Talia Ralph and Alay Trong. Special thanks to Paula Schumann and Chris Bannon. Happy Thanksgiving, one and all. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.